Hello and welcome. The old saying, good things come to those who wait. Well, we've waited a little bit, but I think this is going to be an amazing beer and food pairing that we have for you here at the Beer and Food Pavilion at the 2014 GABF. So welcome. Tonight, we've got two great speakers from Christian Moorlein Lagerhouse. Those you're about to find out, they do far more than lagers and have an amazing set of beers that they're going to be pairing with some great food tonight. We've got Greg Wilson, who's the head brewer. And we've got Lee, who's the sous chef at Christian Moorlein Lagerhouse. Without further ado, I'll turn it over to them. Thanks, guys, for being here.
Good evening, everyone. How's everybody doing tonight? I was expecting a little bit more of a drunk crowd by this point in the evening. Socially and lubricated appropriately on the amazing beverages we have here today. So the Lagerhouse opened up just about 2.5 years ago. We work with Christian Moorlein Brewing Company, who is going to be the parent organization. That is our production company where these bottles came from that you'll be drinking tonight. And then we are the brew pub that's downtown. We average about 2,000 barrels a year production. We are called the Lagerhouse. About half our portfolio is lagers. And then we do ales and a lot of experimental beers. We have put about 33 different beers in the course of the last 12 months. So trying to rotate a lot of different varieties. The best part of that is that I have the outlet to have an amazing culinary team to work with to bounce ideas off of. And when I come up with some crazy ideas, Lee has always been willing to help me out with a lot of those and cooking ingredients for that. Lee? All right. So we got the first dish out for you. This is going to be Lee's specialty. He's a chef. I don't know as much about the food. You do have the pamphlets in front of you. The main thing we'll be looking at tonight is going to be that when you flip it open, there'll be the 10 bullet points for basically essentialing a pairing at home. And then we can get involved to the nuts and bolts of what that is. We only had 100 of them. Can anybody share with your neighbors? Some people don't have that. Okay, well, I apologize for people that don't have it. We had 100 pamphlets, so that's all we had available to us for the day. So if anybody is not interested, read it, want to pass it along to their neighbor so they can also read it, please do so. Let's make this a communal environment. Thank you. You're a very generous man. So OTR is going to be the first beer we start out with. OTR is the name of a neighborhood in Cincinnati called Over the Rhine. It is where the Germans settled in the late 1800s. And it was a very big Germanic culture, hence where we pull our name from. Christian Moorlein was also a German immigrant. This beer takes after an English style, an English pale ale. You do have notes inside that pamphlet, basic recipe formulations for you. I didn't scale that down to a homebrew level, but it does give you the IBU counts, your malt percentages, rough fermentation temperature. So if you like any of the beers tonight and you are a home brewer, hopefully you can utilize that to your advantage and or take what you like about the beer and what you don't like, play with it yourself, and that's ultimately the real fun of home brewing. With that, you want to talk about the food there since I don't know much about it?
Absolutely. Oh, sorry. I'm used to yelling in a kitchen. I usually don't need a microphone. The date's a medjool date. They're the sweeter of dates. The bacon jam, it's applewood smoked bacon and onions. You cook it down till it's almost a jam-like consistency. And actually halfway into the process of doing that, rather than substitute a sweetener like a bourbon or a coffee, I decided to throw the beer in with it. You cook it down till it's almost a jam. Then you pulse it in a food processor really quickly. And the real challenge is pitting the dates. They take an awful lot of time. But where the pit was, leaves you a nice space to put that bacon jam. Made a balsamic reduction, put that on there. I think the acidity ties nicely with it, with the fattiness of the dates and the bacon. It's a pretty simple thing. It's just a little time consuming.
So a raise of hands. How many people have hosted a beer dinner at your house or done any food and beer pairings? Who's tried it? Out of those hands, who feels like it was a successful adventure or was there things... Congratulations for you. Is there anybody who had issues with when you did it, not knowing how to properly figure out your portions? For me, that's a huge issue. I always end up with way too much food when I try to do pairings, so it's hard enough to even come up with the concept of what you want. then trying to figure out the nitty-gritty of having to get it executed. So Lee, when you do your beard enters, he's hosted with us, what's been almost 2 years now?
Yeah, that's right.
So 2 years worth of beer dinners. We start out doing a beer dinner every month. We do about every other month now. We've had breweries from Oscar Blues, Upland Brewing Company, Highland Brewing Company, Great Lakes. List goes on and on and on. And he does an amazing job of pairing with it. So I guess, what are your first steps in organizing a beer dinner?
The number one thing is guest count. How many people are you going to have? You know. Oh, yeah. If you're going to have, you know, 30 people, that's great, but you need to have a firm count. If you put a big invite out, 30 respond and 100 show up, now you're left scrambling. So firm guest count. And then what you do is you figure out exactly what amounts of things you want to have on the plate. And by that I mean, do you want the sauce to be all over the plate? Do you want the sauce to be a little dollop? What type of protein are you using? Based on that and your guest count, you know, if you're figuring 2 ounces of sauce per plate, you got 30 people, you need 60 ounces of sauce. And that way, you don't have a lot of waste, don't have a lot of leftover.
Okay, you were saying 2 ounces per plate, usually protein?
Yeah, 2 ounces, 2 to 3 ounces is about average on a plate.
And that usually our dinner is like a 5-course dinner. It's about average, right, 5 or 6?
5 to 6, yeah.
So keep that in mind as far as your plating options. I think when you think about plating, at least when I do, I look at the plate and think about a whole meal. So if I'm planning out 5 different separate entities I want to have portioned out, my initial instincts to think about it is being like, oh yeah, I want like a 4-ounce or 6-ounce cutlet or something. But
well, you have to be careful. You know, if you're doing 5 courses, that's an awful lot of food. It doesn't seem like a whole lot, but it's kind of like these little taster cups here. You have 1 ounce, and suddenly at the end of the day, you don't know how it happened, and you got a bit of a buzz. So, you know, you don't want your guests to be looking at your final course going, oh, man, that looks really good, and I just can't eat it. So do the math on your courses. You don't want anything to go above 2 to 3 ounces of total weight of protein, like if you got steak. You don't want to do more than 3 ounces. If you got fish, you don't want more than 3 ounces. Because at the end of the day, it all adds up to almost a pound of food.
A pound of food for the whole dinner?
Yeah, the whole dinner. By the time they're done eating, they've had a pound of food.
And then we'll also be drinking beer the whole time with that as well?
And then they're a little full.
It's one problem I've definitely had. I think portioning is a huge issue. I've gone to beer dinners where I've left and felt so bloated, it's uncomfortable. And even if everything is absolutely amazing, like Lee is saying, the finishing memory of what you walk away with from that experience is going to be the one you retain. So you always want to leave on the best impression. So finish strong. And I think it's really making sure that they're satiated, but not wanting more and not feeling the point where you're really about to explode. And it's gotten to the point where I can't even drink more beer, which is unheard of. So,
yeah, you know, going along with that, the first thing you have to do is figure out what beer you're going to do with it. You know, are you going to pick a single brewery? Do you want to do a single style? Do you want to just take your favorite ones and, you know, bring some people over, introduce them to that? You pick your beer first, and everything else kind of falls into place. Once you have your beer, you can taste it. Once you taste it, you can write your menu. You can figure out what you want to do. Once you want to do, you write your menu, get a shopping list. But it all starts really with the beer.
So with the date, when you were doing this, so beer first, food second, right? That's in that pamphlet. Always select your beers and work around your beer. What did you get, Lee, out of that beer that made you go for this?
It had a really good malt characteristic. Tasted really kind of sweet, but had a nice bit of bitterness to back it up. And, you know, sweet and bitter, the only thing it's missing is salty. And there's bacon. Bacon goes with dates, and then you're done.
Cool. And then also one of the key things Lee has always talked to me about with presentation is the garnishment and how much that can affect your perception of the dish. So from a brewing side, we do filter all our beers. It's a really important thing for us, and we feel that the first thing you do when you get a beverage or food, if it doesn't look good, you're more likely to view that as being an inferior product. It has nothing to do with the quality of the product, strictly presentation. So we judge with our eyes first. So filtration for us, a clear beer in a glass will 9 times out of 10 always be voted, barring it's a good quality beer, that it will be perceived as a better beer than a murky beer. If it's really hazy, really turbid. So it's always something to consider, and that's how we present our beers. So with the green, what do you find for his accents?
Yeah, you know, if you have a plate that you're putting barbecue sauce and a brisket and, you know, a potato salad, it sounds delightful, and then you put it on the plate, and you're like, man, it's missing something. So if you got a lot of browns, get something green. If you got a lot of greens, get something brown or red. And it doesn't have to be microgreens. You know, it could be as easy as taking some spinach, sautéing it off in a little bit of liquid, and just at the very end, just pinching a little bit off, putting it on top. It'll brighten the whole plate, bring it all together. It gives you that wow factor, separates your dish from everyone else's. And at the end of the day, people are going to perceive it before they even eat it, and it's going to taste better in their minds before it even hits their mouth. And that's half the battle.
Oh, yeah, you need a microphone.
Yeah.
We had a gentleman who had a question up here.
Yeah.
You didn't talk about the plate itself. I mean, if we're talking about smaller portions, 2 or 3 ounces, and set up in several sequential servings, to put a great big dinner plate in front of somebody with that date on it, for example, and most of us in our home don't have a zillion million little tapas plates. Well, maybe we do, but most of us don't. So, and short of using the paper plates we're using here, any recommendations for doing a beer dinner and finding some nice little better than paper?
Absolutely. I like to go to thrift shops and the Salvation Army. You get all kinds of really cool older plates. They don't have to be matching sets, you know. No one's going to sit down and be upset that, you know, Bill got the red plate and I got the blue plate. What matters is more consistency of dimension, okay? You don't want someone having a platter, another person having a tea saucer. So, yeah, thrift stores, Salvation Army, and in a pinch, you can always just, most people would have 4 or 5 bread or butter plates in their house. You know, you can bust those out. Anything you want that will reflect the size of your dish is really what you can get.
Did that answer the question for you? Okay. It was actually something I never even thought about. Lee brought that up. And that most of us, when we do think about hosting dinners, it didn't even occur to me that I don't probably have enough saucer plates in my house to even roll through more than 4 people. And it was one of the first questions I had. Is like, well, how the hell do you manage that? And then it's dishes or like silverware. I don't have enough silverware to manage rotating through 3 courses with people. So then building into the cycle is something he was talking about. We have to do at the restaurant as far as cycle time for dishes to get them back out. So then it gets to be really creative control of your audience. And one thing I've always found on my end to be a really, people love to be engaged. People love being in the kitchen. And if they're a guest of your house, they always want to help out in some capacity. And not to make it into a labor issue with them that you put your guests over and put them to work. But I think it makes a more communal experience with the meal. And ultimately, it shouldn't be strictly just about you providing something to someone else. It should be about them engaging back. And the more that engagement happens, I think that's really what makes beer the ultimate communal beverage. That's one thing I've thought about a lot.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I actually did a beer dinner for one of our servers. It was his grandmother's 78th birthday. She was flying in from out of town. He's like, can you help me out? Can you do something? I'm like, yeah, man, I'll come over. So I went over there. By the end of the day, grandma, mom, dad, the 3 brothers, I had them all in the kitchen working for me, and I was half sitting back. So not only can you bring people together, it can also take a little bit of stress off of you, as well as give everyone a little bit of sense of ownership in the meal itself. It's not, I did this, it's, hey, look what we did.
I got to look to my notes here. I can get easily off track. Too much time in Denver has made my mind a little mushy, so I appreciate your patience. So we went over guest count, and the next bullet point is going to be knowing your audience. And this is something critical from the basics of humor to food, to everything else. If you tell a joke that's inappropriate for the audience that you're trying to tell it to, it's going to fail. So knowing who you're presenting to is really critical. So Lee, when you're thinking about this and you have a difference, we get a lot of corporate groups that come in for lunches, and then we also get to do beer dinners. So if you're doing a beer tasting, how would you differentiate between somebody who's going to be there specifically for nuanced flavor profiles versus somebody who's there as a luncheon?
Well, definitely the meal you're putting out is influenced by the people you have coming over. You know, if half your friends don't like mushrooms, then you probably shouldn't put mushrooms in. But knowing their likes, their dislikes, their allergies, all that's important. The main thing that rings true in my head for knowing your audience is I came in one day and my chef told me that, this was years ago, my chef told me that I had 150 people coming in and I needed a grilled tomato salsa. So I spent 4 or 5 hours skinning, de-seeding, perfect brunoise, small dice on everything. Chef came back in, he's like, that is great. Now put it in the blender. It's 150 15-year-olds. Nobody cares about your perfect dice or your de-seeded tomato. So from that point on, age, background, everything is important so you don't end up wasting a whole lot of time. If you have people that come over that just really don't care how you put it on the plate, as long as it all comes together, you can still make it look good. You just don't have to agonize over it. And that story haunts me still.
And the reason we got in this conversation was back to the idea of protein and volume on your plate. So how do you know how much you need to buy? Knowing who your audience coming over is, are they more into fish? Are they more into shellfish? Are they more into meat? What kind of meat is it? And that way, if they're really big beef eaters, you know that you can get more beef for that particular dish than, say, something like shellfish if they're not really into mussels or whatever else it could be. So it's where we started that whole conversation off.
Yeah, also, you know, if you're trying to plan out how much meat to buy, depending on the fat content in it, if you're buying like a flank steak and you got 10 people coming over, you're going to put about 3 ounces on the plate. You're going to probably lose a tiny bit when you cook the flank. So you probably need, you need 30 ounces. So I'd get 3 pounds. That 6 ounces will account for waste. Lost due to cooking, the juices come out, the fat renders out. And that way you're not left with, 10 pounds of brisket left over that you just don't have anything to do with.
Yeah, and one of the other points on here is using consistent units of measurement. If it's going to be weight or volume, I know one propensity I have when I'm cooking is just to go to the store, buy what I have the impulse to buy. I was reading some article. That sounds really great, so I want to go with that. But I don't know how much to buy. I haven't thought about it. So when you're thinking about dinners, I mean, when you go with weight versus volume, do you have any issues if you start switching between the two as far as consistency with the menu or...
Weight and volume is really only important when you're cooking. If it's a dry item, it's weight. If it's a wet item, it's volume. That's really the only thing it comes down to with food.
Cool. We got another dish coming out for you here. This is going to be paired with our Seven Weiss. It's our southern German style Hefeweizen. So with this beer style, you're going to get a lot of banana, a lot of clove character, natural from the fermentation profile. There's no additive ingredients in there to give that flavor profile. So if you're familiar with styles, hopefully most of us are. We do use about a 72 degree fermentation on this, trying to drive the banana note forward, pulling back on that clove character, the phenols, spice notes. It's also only about 18 IBUs, so a very light beer as far as the bitterness count. And alcohol, it falls into one of our lowest that we offer consistently. Hefeweizen is one of my favorite beers. It's definitely the beer for after work. Light enough in texture, acidity in the back end, that it can be just a easy drinking after work beer. But by the same token, and it's similar to a lot of the Belgian styles, it is amazingly food friendly. There's so many complex nuances in this beer to start working with it. And then I'll give it over to Chef Lee here so he can talk more about how, when you taste that beer, what do you pull out of there, and how would you start building a menu around that?
Honestly, the first thing I got was banana, and that's where it went after that. You know, I taste food from a culinary standpoint, not a brewing standpoint. Whatever you taste, that's what you want to build off of. Or if you really want to, if you're a little more advanced, you want to contrast the flavors, it's what you don't taste that you want to put in there. So You know, I taste a banana. Banana goes great with a lot of earthy things. Goat cheese is pretty earthy. Honey, sweet and earthy. And make a goat cheese honey. It's really just whip the honey, fold goat cheese in. And actually with this one, I decided at the end to add a little bit of the beer into it, and it really brightened it up. You wouldn't know it was in there unless I didn't put it in there and had you taste it afterwards. But the beer just added a tiny bit of tanginess that honey was missing. But I think it all ties really well together with that.
And this we were talking about this a lot earlier today, the idea of when you're using beer with food. How much do you want that beer to be showcased in the actual food dish, or do you want that to accentuate? So from my mindset, I don't know where Lee is with this, but my concept is if you're using that flavor, it should be a buttress, a support note. I don't think the beer should scream through in the final product on a personal level. I don't know. What's your take on it?
Understated is usually best. If your whole dish tastes like beer, then you probably used a little too much. You have your main flavor. Everything else should definitely support it, coincide with it, add to it. The goal at the end is to have you take a bite of the sauce, the banana, a sip of the beer. The goal is for everything to come together seamlessly and hopefully create a new flavor or a new experience with that beer. You know, that's the pairing of food and beer, a lot like the pairing of food and wine, except without all the snobbery of it. Because whatever you taste is what you taste, and, you know, no one's going to come along and tell you, oh, this has hints of toasted leather and, you know, yada, yada, yada. It's whatever you get is what you get, and if it's good, then you did the right thing.
One thing to talk about, we're talking about he tasted banana, and I think that's a pretty obvious flavor profile in this beer, and talking somewhat to the idea of somebody coming and giving you some really elaborate, prosy description of what a beer is. The idea of using a common language set so you know how to interpret flavors is really critical. So Lee turned me on to the book on here, which was the culinary, was it the terminology, basically the Bible?
Yeah, the Flavor Bible is really good, but the Food Lover's Companion is fantastic. It's like a dictionary, except it's all food terms. It goes from things dated back to the 1700s all the way up to the most modern gastronomic sauces. And I used to use it as a way to come up with something whenever I was stumped. Like, you get stuck in a rut, you got the same thing over and over again. I'd just root through it and find something that sounded cool and try it out. It's also a great tool to have when you have friends over. They're like, hey, well, what exactly is that? You can look it up. You actually have a standard definition for it.
So how many people in here, raise hands, consider yourself home chefs? So, okay, cool. All right, for me, it's the resource of having Lee available to me is amazing, and it's one of the things where we'll give you the information here on this. You can always go to our website as well, and then you can contact us via, obviously, our website. If you have any further questions as far as concepts or ideas for this and being able to utilize the knowledge of a chef and what resources they have in their library, it's all about building our individual libraries. So hopefully with the essential reading on the back, it has everything from online resources to books, and then obviously there's a podcast on there with the Brewing Network and Homebrewed Chef. Is anybody familiar with the Homebrewed Chef? Sean Paxson's show? So Brewing Network has a booth here. You should go visit it. They have a wonderful Hop Grenade shirt. They also have an amazing podcast, with the Homebrewed Chefs being one of them. So if you don't have time to read, which a lot of us are pressed for, but you have time to listen to a podcast, there's amazing concepts of how to use more raw materials into your dishes, which you guys do a lot, actually, with the restaurant, right?
Yeah. But on the subject of books, there's one that jumps out. It's my favorite book. I told Greg a while back. It's On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee. Especially if you enjoy cooking at home and you want to take it to the next level. He's the world's preeminent food scientist, and he actually explains to you at a molecular level, without being super boring about it, what happens when you caramelize sugar. Why do you need things to be at a certain temperature in order for for them to come together. And he also writes an online column for the New York Times that you can keep up with that is really, really interesting.
And that's always a problem, too. I mean, reading a really terribly shitty book or a very difficult book to read can put you in a tough situation to learn much from it. So hopefully the resources that we're giving you are engaging. You can actually pull a lot of information from it. One thing you can always do, and I know it sounds a hell of a lot easier than it comes into practice, is note cards or creating your own file system for reference material. So when you do these dinners, when you go out to a beer dinner, you're paying good money. Take notes. Use the menu as your own notation device and file it. And you can use that as a resource further down the line so you can start your own library using your own language and your own notes to start building your own menu concepts. So we have the final dish right now that just landed. So I don't know, Lee, you want to talk about the chorizo?
Absolutely. Chorizo is another Spanish term just for sausage. It's usually a spicier sausage, usually a firmer sausage. So it's chorizo that we braised off in the beer for about 2.5 hours, and then paired it with Manchego cheese and made a sherry gastrique. And a gastrique is just, it's the best way to describe it is equal parts sugar and acid. So sugar and orange juice or sugar and vinegar. But for this particular one, I actually used twice the amount of sugar to the vinegar because it's so acidic. I didn't want it to just burn everything on your tongue. And that's another good way to pair things. If you have a single item and you're not really sure what to put with it, finding out what national cuisine it's a part of will give you a direction to look in as to what to pair with it. Manchego is a Spanish sheep's milk cheese. Sherry is a Spanish wine. You can stick with a single national palate, and it's really difficult to go wrong with it, especially if you're not quite sure where else to go with it.
And then on the third page inside the pamphlet, there is recipes for the stuffed dates and the sherry gastrique. So just really a resource for you to take home. I'll try to make it as user-friendly for you as possible. I also have the Northern Liberty recipe in there. This is our IPA. Once again, it's another Cincinnati reference. We take a lot of pride in our community. And finally, I've been a lifer in Cincinnati. We're actually finally seeing development, and we're about 14 breweries currently, with at least two or three more slated to open up. So we're finally entering into young adulthood as far as a city that really had massive troubles after Prohibition. We lost basically most of our breweries, and building back to a point that we're really excited about. It's in no way comparable to the awesomeness of what is Denver and the Colorado brewing scene, but we do have great water and we do have a great brewing culture. So we're really happy to bring that back. And Northern Liberties is going to be a reference to a street in Cincinnati called Liberty Avenue. So basically anything outside of that district was going to be more of the body, seedy, dicey area. You're out of city limits. More things could happen. Fitting with our persona as being more of a German lineage, German heritage brewery, this beer was one of the first ones that really stepped outside of the gate of our brewing protocol or profile. But nobody can brew anything without having an IPA in your portfolio for the most part now. We all love IPAs, so we did more of a classic take on the style. A lot of Centennial, a lot of Cascade, a soft amount of Simcoe and dry hop, just to give it a little bit of that kind of piney resin essence to it, but aiming more towards the citrus zest. So a lot of lemon, and grapefruit, and orange. And then the bitterness is actually about 73, 74 IBUs, so it is pretty firm in comparison to its alcohol level. And once again, we aim for a relatively consumable IPA at 6.5. So for me, I have now a 16-month-old daughter, and I need to run around a lot. And doing that after drinking a lot of 7.2 IPAs doesn't work out so well. So a 6.5 allows me the versatility to drink some beers if I want to after work and still be coherent and manage to be a good father.
Yeah, ABV is definitely something to consider when you're actually coming up with a menu. I mean, if you've got a 10% alcohol beer on there, you better have something heavy to help them sop that up. Whereas if you have, you know, a 4.2, a lighter IPA, a lighter wit beer, you know,
you pair your food also, not only with the flavor of the beer, but with the alcohol content as well. You go lighter with lighter, heavier with heavier, and that's going to save your guests a lot of hangovers the next day.
Yeah, you don't like hangovers after a nice beer dinner?
I've seen it.
One thing, usually when I do beer tastings, if I'm doing just straight beer, I always go to the least bitter to the most bitter. A lot of times with our beer dinners, though, we do throw IPAs in the middle of the dinner. So is there a concept on your end as far as breaking up the palate and the structure of how the meals are starting to lay on your tongue? Or
really what I do is when I taste the beers and I write my menu, then I figure out where does that food belong in the mix, and I make the beer fall in line with the food, not vice versa. Having beer in the wrong order is forgivable to the palate, especially when you're sitting down at dinner, but having a chilled tomato soup come out after a barbecued brisket or a mole short rib, it's just going to confuse everybody.
Yeah, and I guess one of the final points of what we put on here is perfection can be the enemy of great. So I think if you're really tied up with trying to aim towards perfection, I think it's obviously a good goal. But is perfect attainable? Is it really going to be available to you? And one thing we didn't go over on here is adaptability. Being adaptable is really, and this is going to be up to Lee to talk about, but watching them work in the kitchen, that I plan out my brews so far in advance. I get the malt in. I know what my brew cycles are. It's a very easy production cycle for me. And shit always goes wrong in the kitchen. That's kind of the motto. So how do you manage if you want to get a certain protein and it's not available, either for cost or your supplier doesn't have it? So, I mean, you have to work on the fly.
At the very end of the day, at least from a restaurant perspective, if you have to substitute something, you always make sure to substitute something better. No one's ever complained that they got filet instead of meatloaf. If I ran out of meatloaf, I'll shoot you a filet. But you never fall in love with your plan. Your core ingredients, your core flavors are what's important. The protein you can work around it an awful lot. And at the last second, you know, if you're a little short on flank, then, you know, maybe run out and grab some skirt steak. It's a cheaper thing, but the flavor profile is exactly the same. You can throw it in there. Or you can always... The dish is always adaptable. That's really... There's nothing set in stone.
Do we have any questions?
So I've been a cook for a while now, and I've been serving for a little while. Some of the questions that I've gotten are about our original gravity. What purpose does that serve in brewing? I understand that some of the volume that it takes consists with original gravity. However, I don't see how it affects the flavor or the experience of drinking.
Are you talking about the original gravity I put on the handouts?
Yes. I also have them over at the brewing mats that we have over at Rock Bottom that we have as well. And I get questions about original gravity. And when I talk to my brewer, he often suggests that it simply defines the density of the brew. But I'm unsure of how that affects the brew itself or how it affects the taste of the brew.
It's a really good question. So I'd say the first concept of putting OG on a menu is more an informational standpoint for the consumer that a lot of restaurants do. I do agree with you. Putting OG alone does not give you any idea about what the beer is. It only tells you this is my specific starting sugar concentration, but my terminal is more what's important there. So when you have that little handout, you have an OG and a final gravity. That difference is going to be more important. So if you start out at 15 Plato and end up at 5 Plato versus 2, you're going to have a lot more residual sugar. So it's kind of like giving a consumer half the information. But it's been more kind of, I think, a process of ritualistic menu design instead of being really about giving core information that's essential for somebody to use. So it's a really great question. Do we have anybody else that had any other questions? Yes.
I was just wondering, do you have the most success? I noticed with beer dinners, they kind of do light to dark beers, appetizers to desserts. Is that kind of the most successful way of doing things? Or do you ever think about doing like a lot of dark beers with a lineup of desserts, or a lot of light beers with a lineup of appetizers, or vice versa? Is that just kind of the best way to do it?
Well, dessert last is usually the only rule that I follow when coming up with a menu. And in the beginning, I had a really difficult time. I'm used to everything being, like you said, amuse-bouche, then you have your salad, then your soup, then your app, then your entree. And I found that that didn't really apply here. It's more of a tapas approach, like they use in Spain. Like, every plate's a small plate. Now, if it helps you to come up with dishes to do it with, then, you know, use the rule of, you know, soup, salad, app, entree, and that'll give you at least a framework to work off of. We usually take the sweetest and darkest beer for the last course, and we usually take the lightest beer for the first course, but everything in the middle, it's just whatever dish you want to have next, that's the beer that's going next. Does that help? Excellent. Does anyone else have a question? Yes, sir.
When integrating beer into a recipe, I found I had a lot of trouble with hoppier beers. Do you have any tips on how to kind of tackle the hop profile of a beer in a recipe?
Absolutely. When you're adding something, let's say it's to a sauce, okay? When you're reducing that sauce down, it's water that you're losing. So whatever significant flavor you're going to you have in the beer is going to multiply, as you probably know, about tenfold. So if you have something super bitter, either put it with something bitter like grapefruit juice. Okay, a little bit of extra bitterness. Go with ruby red, something a little sweeter. You add the beer to it. It doesn't mask the bitterness, but it kind of takes it with it. And or you can use honey. I like honey. I like agave nectar. They always go well. Or you can just go the other direction and make it really spicy. Not, you know, melt your mouth spicy, but a little sriracha takes bitterness and turns it into a really tasty thing. Does that help? All right. Anyone else?
If there are no other questions, I'd like to thank our two great speakers, Greg and Lee from Christian Marline Lagerhaus in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thanks, guys, for being here.